14. Dying Words. In September 1925, as White tried to determine what secrets William Hale and his nephews Ernest and Brian were hiding, he wondered if one person had previously uncovered them. Bill Smith, Molly Burkhart's brother-in-law. It was Smith who had first suspected that Lizzie was poisoned, and he who had investigated whether there was a larger conspiracy connected to the family's oil wealth. If Smith was killed because of what he had learned, that information might be the key to unlocking the inside world. After the explosion destroyed the Smiths' house, agents asked the nurse who had been on duty when Bill was being treated in the hospital whether he had mentioned anything about the murders. She said that Bill had often muttered names in his feverish sleep, but she had been unable to make them out. Sometimes when he woke up, he seemed worried that he might have said something in his sleep, something that he shouldn't have. Shortly before Bill died, the nurse recalled, he had met with his doctors, James and David Schoen, and with his lawyer. The doctors had asked the nurse to leave the room. It was clear that they didn't want her to overhear their conversation with Bill, and she suspected that he had given some sort of statement indicating who was responsible for blowing up his house. White, already suspicious of the Schoens owing to the missing bullet in the Anna Brown case, began to question each person who had been in the room with Bill. Later, federal prosecutors also questioned these men. According to a transcript of these interrogations, David Schoen acknowledged that he and his brother had summoned the lawyer, believing that Bill might name his killers, but nothing came of it. If Bill Smith had an idea who blowed him up, he never said, the doctor recalled. One of the prosecutors pressed him about why it had been so important for the nurse to leave the room. Schoen explained that nurses often leave when the doctors come in. If she says that you asked her to step out, she lies? No, sir, if she says that, I did. Schoen said he would swear a dozen times that Bill never identified his killers. Pointing to his hat, he added, Bill Smith gave me that hat, and he is my friend. James Schoen, David's brother, was equally adamant, telling the prosecutor he never did say who blew him up. He must have talked about that. He never did say who blew him up. Did he talk about who blew him up? He didn't talk about who blew him up. When Bill Smith's lawyer was questioned, he too insisted that he had no idea who was responsible for blowing up the Smiths' house. Gentlemen, it is a mystery to me, he said. But as he was being grilled, he revealed that in the hospital, Bill Smith had said, You know, I only had two enemies in the world, and that those enemies were William K. Hale, the king of the Osage Hills, and his nephew, Ernest Burkhart. The investigators asked James Schoen about this, and eventually he divulged the truth. I would hate to say positively that he said that Bill Hale blew him up, but he did say Bill Hale was his only enemy. What did he say about Ernest Burkhart? A prosecutor asked. He said they were the only two enemies he knew of. The Schoens were close to Hale and the Burkharts, having been their family's physicians, and not long after the conversation at the hospital, one of the Schoen brothers informed the nurse that Brian Burkhart was ill. She was asked to visit Brian at his house, and she agreed to do so. While she was there, Hale showed up. He conferred privately with Brian, then approached the nurse. After some small talk, he asked her if Bill Smith had named his killers before he died. The nurse told him, if he did, I would not be telling it. Hale seemed to be trying to ascertain whether she knew anything and perhaps to be warning her not to divulge a word if she did. As White and agents dug deeper into the hospital statement, they began to suspect that the doctors had orchestrated the private meeting with Bill Smith not for his testimony, but rather for another ulterior motive. During the meeting, James Schoen was named the administrator of the estate of Bill Smith's murdered wife, Rita, which allowed him to execute her will. Such a position was coveted by whites, for it paid unconscionably high fees and provided ample opportunities for graft. After White's team uncovered the scheme, one of the prosecutors questioned David Schoen about it. You understand in your study of medicine the requisite of a dying declaration, he said. You weren't undertaking to get anything like that?
No, Schoen replied meekly.
It was now clear why the doctors had summoned not the sheriff or a prosecutor, but Bill Smith's personal attorney. They had asked him to bring the paperwork for Bill to sign before he died. Another prosecutor asked David Schoen if Bill was even lucid enough to make such a decision. Did he know what he was signing? I suppose he did. He was supposed to be rational. You are a doctor. Was he rational? He was rational. And he made arrangements for your brother to be appointed for his wife's estate? Yes, sir. After further interrogation, he conceded. A very wealthy estate. The more White investigated the flow of oil money from Osage headrights, the more he found layer upon layer of corruption. Although some white guardians and administrators tried to act in the best interests of the tribe, countless others used the system to swindle the very people they were ostensibly protecting. Many guardians would purchase for their wards goods from their own stores or inventories at inflated prices. One guardian bought a car for $250 and then resold it to his ward for $1,250. Or guardians would direct all of their ward's business to certain stores and banks in return for kickbacks. Or guardians would claim to be buying homes and land for their wards while really buying these for themselves. Or guardians would outright steal. One government study estimated that before 1925, guardians had pilfered at least $8 million directly from the restricted accounts of their Osage wards. The blackest chapter in the history of this state will be the Indian guardianship over these estates, an Osage leader said, adding, there has been millions, not thousands, but millions of dollars of many of the Osages dissipated and spent by the guardians themselves. This so-called Indian business, as White discovered, was an elaborate criminal operation in which various sectors of society were complicit. The crooked guardians and administrators of Osage estates were typically among the most prominent white citizens, businessmen and ranchers and lawyers and politicians. So were the lawmen and prosecutors and judges who facilitated and concealed the swindling and sometimes acted as guardians and administrators themselves. In 1924, the Indian Rights Association, which defended the interests of indigenous communities, conducted an investigation into what it described as an orgy of graft and exploitation. The group documented how rich Indians in Oklahoma were being shamelessly and openly robbed in a scientific and ruthless manner, and how guardianships were the plums to be distributed to the faithful friends of the judges as a reward for their support at the polls. Judges were known to say to citizens, "You vote for me, and I will see that you get a good guardianship." A white woman married to an Osage man described to a reporter how the locals would plot. A group of traders and lawyers sprung up who selected certain Indians as their prey. They owned all the officials. These men had an understanding with each other. They cold-bloodedly said, "You take so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and I'll take these." They selected Indians who had full headrights and large farms. Some of the schemes were beyond depraved. The Indian Rights Association detailed the case of a widow whose guardian had absconded with most of her possessions. Then the guardian falsely informed the woman who had moved from Osage County that she had no more money to draw on, leaving her to raise her two young children in poverty. For her and her two small children, there was not a bed, nor a chair, nor food in the house, the investigator said. When the widow's baby got sick, the guardian still refused to turn over any of her money, though she pleaded for it. Without proper food and medical care, the baby died, the investigator said. The Osage were aware of such schemes, but had no means to stop them. After the widow lost her baby, evidence of the fraud was brought before a county judge only to be ignored. There is no hope of justice so long as these conditions are permitted to remain, the investigator concluded. The human cry of this woman is a call to America. An Osage speaking to a reporter about the guardian stated, "Your money draws them, and you're absolutely helpless. They have all the law and all the machinery on their side. Tell everybody when you write your story, that they're scalping our souls out here.